to the Apologetics Canada podcast. This is Steve Kim, your host. And as usual, I'm here with Andy Steiger and Chris Battle.
Good to be here.
Hey, how you doing?
All right. So we're going to continue on in our series in cults and world religions. And we left off with part two of Mormonism last week. And we're launching into Islam today. But before we get there, we started a segment where we kind of discuss briefly, or as briefly as we can, some of the things that are that we're seeing in the news these days. So, Andy, you pulled out something.
Well, I noticed in the Economist, the latest Economist, this is from June 6th to 12th edition, that the front cover, the title of the front cover is Losing the Middle East. And the subtitle is Why America Must Not Abandon the Region. This is something that we're seeing more and more is this idea of, you know, what is America's responsibility specifically in Iraq, and what should their position be towards ISIS and what's going on?
Right. It's a pretty kind of, it's a contended issue, right? You know, whether it is. Whether America is doing more harm than good by being there.
Well, it's kind of interesting because the question's not necessarily are they doing more harm than good by being there, but in the policies that they want to implement by being there. You know, we just combine those two, but there's in the Economist that they're making a distinction that there's, you know, there's two things that are happening. One is democracy that seems to work in the West doesn't necessarily work in the East, in the Middle East. But then beyond that is, you know, even though that's the case, does that mean, though, that we shouldn't still be involved in what's going on in the Middle East? And it's interesting because the Economist just went straight out and said, listen, we think that the U.S. needs to be in the Middle East, particularly in Iraq, and dealing with what's going on there. Now, what's intriguing on this whole topic, though, for me as an American, is a lot of people don't understand, like, the American mind, if you will,
right,
when we think about Iraq or what's going on in the Middle East. Because a lot of people think, oh, there's the U.S., you know, and they're being the world's police again, and they're putting their nose in everyone's business.
Save the day.
Yeah, exactly. Like, and the funny thing is, though, is that's a very post-World War II mindset that the U.S. adopted in light of how slow we were to get involved in World War I and World War II. And seeing, particularly in World War II, seeing the devastating effects of being slow to get into that war and the atrocities that took place, you know, to humanity. So it's almost like there's this fear not to let that happen again that you'll find in the American mind. And almost this responsibility that we've screwed up once, we're, it's almost like this overcompensation for not screwing up again.
Yeah, because anybody who's a student of World War II, I've read and watched plenty about it. And if the states had gone in earlier, I think it's without contention that
not as many people would have died.
Oh, not even close, right?
Yeah.
But their prudence in that sense led to, didn't lead to more deaths, but it fewer deaths were avoided.
And so I think what you find then is the U.S. realizes that they have a responsibility at some level. And I think that everyone, if you think about it, the U.S. and their wealth, their strategic location, and their military, they at some level actually do have a responsibility.
Well, look at it like this. If I'm walking down the street, right, and I see Steve just pounding Andy on the side of the road, you wouldn't say to me if I went to jump in and tried to clear things up that I was, you know, you're Chris, you know, you're stepping outside your boundaries. Your boundary is that side of the road. You have to stay over there. And if Steve wants to pound Annie into submission and make him cry, then do you know what I mean? Do you know what I'm saying? Like, I'm saying kind of funny, but it's you wouldn't say that to me. It would be, if anything, if I didn't do anything, I would get chastised for not getting involved.
Yeah, well, I know for one that if I'm getting beaten up on one side of the road and I saw you walking by on the other side of the road, and if I saw you just walk by,
yeah,
we would have some serious conversations afterwards, you know.
As we
if
should.
If you're a friend, right, or even as a stranger, how can you just let that happen, right?
It's a good Samaritan.
It's almost like it sounds to me like the responsibility to protect doctrine that was sort of developed by the Canadian government, and as I understand it, developed by the Canadian government and then adopted by the UN.
I was just going to say, this right? This conversation really goes back to the UN, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That we would say, okay, big brothers, mm-hmm. you know, the UN, have a responsibility to oversee these things. But amongst the UN, we would say that the U.S. has a dominant role just because of wealth and military might. But there's other countries, too, though, that have... that need to take responsibility. And the problem is, though, they're not. And if anything, we've got other countries that are causing issues, mm-hmm. such as China and their interests in the South China Sea right now.
Right.
And other issues where these are people that could have a real influence in our world and historically have not, in fact, have historically not held to trade embargoes and whatnot. So... yeah. It constantly is pushing the U.S. If we were in a perfect world, that, you know, or the U.N. worked appropriately, this would work great. Yeah. But the problem is we're not seeing that. And so it's interesting, though, that the economists, and we're starting to see this more and more, they're just saying, listen, what's going on in the Middle East is starting to just unravel. And if things aren't done... it's only going to get worse. And as we've already been seeing in the news, the atrocities that are taking place are only getting worse. And so it comes back to this whole just war theory thing, right? Now it's like, okay, do we need to go back? Are we just peacekeepers? Is this going to be another war or fight? I mean, man, it's complicated. And if anything, I tell you, it reminds me of when I'm reading the Old Testament. And sometimes when you're reading the Old Testament, it can be... you feel sometimes like you're jumping halfway into a story and you're like, man, God, why did you do this? Or why did they do that? Or, you know, and when you get into the details of something, you begin to see, wow, things are a lot more complicated than you originally thought they would be. And Iraq has just turned out to be incredibly complicated, particularly with regards to the whole ISIS issue. I mean, but... It's complicated there in general. It was funny. I was reading in the Economist, one of their new weapons. I guess actually Israel's been using this new weapon in their dealings in the Middle East to try to keep peace since 2008, I believe it is. They have this. I just thought this was interesting because in the U.S., I mean, they've got their own issues right now. I was even reading an article about how. Police officers in Baltimore and whatnot, I mean, they just don't even feel like they can do their job anymore. And that's becoming a bit of a disaster. And how do you deal with rioting and whatnot? And so they were talking about how Israel has been dealing with rioting in Jerusalem and particularly with the Palestinians. And they use this weapon called Skunk.
Skunk. That's a name for a weapon.
And apparently the U.S. police are starting to look into using the same thing. I just thought it was amusing. But this thing, it basically, what they do to get rid of rioters or to try to keep the peace is foul smell. That's, you know, obviously that's why they call it skunk.
Yeah.
So apparently this smell is just horrendous. It's a smell of sewage mixed with putrefying cow's carcass.
Oh, wow. That's rich.
That'll clear a room.
It'll clear a room. And apparently... It'll get in your clothes and it like gets into your nose, like you just can't even get the smell out.
Nasty.
Have you guys ever been abroad in Asia? They have this fruit there that smells like rotten sewage.
I think I've heard about it. I've never seen. I mean, I'm from Asia, but I haven't actually seen one.
I think when I was in Indonesia, there was something foul smelling that they talked about.
I am all of a sudden forgetting that somebody's got to Google the name of this fruit. I'm forgetting the name of this thing. But it was funny because when I've been in Singapore, they have signs there that say, listen, you can't eat this fruit in these areas. Like, it's forbidden because the thing just smells so bad.
Durian.
Yeah, there it is, durian. So this is a durian fruit. But so at any rate, this is how they're dealing with...
it's like eating kimchi in public places.
Oh, man. Kimchi, dude, that is disgusting. I one time had a Korean foreign exchange student. Mm-hmm. And I remember walking to my house and getting karate punched in the nose, in the senses, by the most horrendous smell. And I remember thinking, there's somebody dead in my house. Like, there is a dead body. And I'm like...
Dead Korean?
I'm like pulling one of those, you know, like... You know, sniffing out the smell, you know, and it's like dragging you around the house as you're trying to figure out where is this horrendous stench coming from. And it leads me to the refrigerator, and tucked in the back of the refrigerator, and she like triple bagged her kimchi, thinking that that could contain this horrendous odor.
Sometimes it's not that successful.
I don't know that you can contain that smell. At any rate, it was, I had to like sit her down and just be like, listen, you can never, ever bring this back into our house again. What is it made of, man?
It's basically Korean cabbage that's pickled and fermented.
So and basically spicy. It's rotten cabbage.
It's like sauerkraut, but
spicy.
Supersized.
Yeah, here's the thing. I've eaten sauerkraut, and I've smelled sauerkraut.
It's nothing like
kimchi.
It's the spices, really. Garlic and green onion and all that kind of stuff.
Are you a fan?
Ginger. Oh, I'm a huge fan.
Dude.
And what's even...
Steve kills himself some kimchi, dude.
It sounds like you need to have Andy over for some kimchi.
No.
You just gotta have it with the right stuff. Like, it goes really well with meat, that sort of thing. But if you're just... I've had a friend whose brother liked kimchi so much, he just had it raw. And as a Korean, even I couldn't understand that. I'm like, that dude is just on a whole other level. But that's another story altogether. So back to Islam, by the way. ISIS.
Nice segue.
That is a good segue. I think there's a lot of people out there, too, that would just be wondering what ISIS is.
Yeah.
What does that even represent, the name?
And it's known by various different names, too, right? ISIS or... Islamic State, so IS.
Yeah, that would be their...
ISIL.
Yeah, ISIL. Because it started off with... ISIS wasn't even actually... They didn't even self-identify with ISIS. That was what we sort of... Or people in the West kind of did. Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. But they were more like ISIL. Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. And the Levant, the states there is like, you know, Cyprus and Jordan and Iraq and Palestine and whatnot. But then as recently as June of last year, they've changed their name to just Islamic State. Because before, they in the title, it would that was where they were going to set up their territory. But now they've considered themselves, or they've declared themselves, a worldwide caliphate. Mm-hmm. Correct pronunciation?
Caliphate. That's one of those.
Yeah, we'll look it up later.
Yeah, Caliphate.
Caliphate's how I always pronounce it.
Caliphate. And the Caliph is Baghdadi. Baghdadi is their Caliph, and he's now a self-proclaimed ruler of Islam's worldwide as of 2014.
Who?
Baghdadi.
Oh, okay.
Baghdadi, sorry.
And where is he located?
He's itinerant. You would say, yeah, they probably move him around quite a bit because he's a pretty wanted guy.
I was just going to say, I'm guessing this guy's like on your most wanted list.
Yeah, as the leader. Yeah, it's al-Baghdadi.
Must be a pretty scary thing to have the most powerful military in the world chasing after your neck.
That wouldn't be a pleasant thing.
No.
Now, it seems to me that there's different countries that harbor these guys. Was it Yemen seems to be one of them?
It's split up. Like, they've been linked to places in, like, Nigeria's had links now with Islamic State. Sorry, it was Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi is the name. Nigeria, there's links now to... all throughout the Middle East, and even they're starting to get a lot of international recruits and stuff like that are interested in helping out. So realistically, he could end up anywhere.
That's one of the things that's been. I was reading this as well. I believe it was in The Economist. Maybe it was on CNN News. They were talking about how the Brits. They estimate that they've got about 700 people that have returned from fighting in Syria
for ISIS that have returned back into the UK and have come back with their, you know, radicalized ideologies. So it's pretty scary because that's taking place around the world.
Yeah. Well, there was Jihadi John. I don't know if you recall from it was I believe he was in the one with the Coptic Christian beheadings, the one on the beach.
Right. Yeah.
And I believe there was a gentleman by he went under the name Jihadi John was identified. He was wearing a Pittsburgh Pirates ball cap, but he was evidently a Brit or so he had ties to the UK. And so they were denouncing his any sort of role, whatever. But
and I guess that's the thing, right? This isn't just taking place in Iraq or Syria. I mean, this is taking place
of all places.
It's being exported all over the world.
Yeah. Yeah. Of all places, there was a young man, a 19-year-old man from Korea, of all places, who went to Turkey and then just disappeared. And turns out later he joined Islamic State. I'm like, Korea, of all places. Islam is not even a, I mean, Islam is there, but it's not really an entity in people's mind, like everyday people's mind.
I'm convinced personally that this is just an evil sin issue, and you've got people that are looking for ways to justify the desires in their hearts and to,
I agree.
With whether it be to, control people, kill people, you know, you name it. This is an opportunity for them to act out on power and sin.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Even with this young man from Korea, like he is known to have been a loner, something of a loner.
Yeah,
and he always, I guess, wanted some kind of significance in his life. And I guess the question is, well, how do you define significance? Because if you're defining it by power, basically, you know, controlling other people and things like that, then yeah, you would want to. And I get, and I find that this is happening a lot in Europe too, where all these young men and women are leaving their sort of the Western world to join ISIS. I was reading,
this looks a lot like what we've seen in other cults, right?
Right.
Where the times are ripe, if you will, for this kind of thing, where you got high unemployment in Europe, a lot of dissatisfaction, a lot of people that are looking for meaning and purpose, and this does it. It provides it, and they have they got time on their hands.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly, because the way the West, what we're doing right now is we're not giving people a vision, or there doesn't seem to be an overarching vision for purpose in life. People are sort of just aimlessly walking through it. I was reading a piece where they talked about why people are becoming so infatuated with radical Islamic groups is because it gives them something real and tangible to follow after, a sense of deep-seated purpose and meaning, something that can take their lives and transform them into something, as you were saying, seems significant.
Right.
But they're obviously, their idea of what is significant, they're almost taking what they can get or latching onto the first thing that presents itself or the first major option.
In a sense that presents us as Christians an opportunity, right? If we can bring that sense of transcendent purpose, it's just secular societies are incapable of, you know, imbuing this sort of sense of objective meaning, because, well, according to the naturalistic worldview, there is no such thing, and that's so much where the West is kind of leaning towards.
And that's definitely a part of it. And I think another big reason that we're seeing a lot of this taken off and spreading is because persecution has a way of fanning into flame ideologies. Mm-hmm. It does it for Christianity. We always see Christianity grow in countries that is being persecuted.
China.
Such as China, such as Laos. Mm-hmm.
The blood of the martyr is the seed of the church.
Yeah, right? and it's not just true of Christianity. We've seen this happen with cults. Mm-hmm. We talked about this with Mormonism. It's happened with them, and we're seeing this happen with Islam. So this actually is a good segue for us to now begin to jump into talking about what does Islam teach and believe, because I get a lot of questions from people going, okay, I don't get it. Why when these magazines, you know, make fun of Muhammad or create these, you know, caricatures of him, you know, why does that incite them to the degree that they would be willing to go and murder people and even kill themselves in the process.
Yeah. And another question to kind of to go with that that gets brought up often is, okay, ISIS, these radical Islam, is what they're doing consistent with what Islam actually teaches? So let's kind of go through some of their briefly their history and what they believe.
So we got,
and then we can.
So let's start at the beginning and kind of work our way forward, and we'll see how far we get today. But one of the things that we said last time, and I don't want to lose this because I think this is a good way for us to jump into Islam, is I said that Mormonism and Islam are actually quite similar.
Yeah, and, you said that, and I'm so curious to hear where that came from.
Do tell. The reason being is because both Mormonism and Islam had similar beginnings, where you've got Muhammad, who's spending time in a cave, and he's greeted by the angel Gabriel, supposedly, and this begins the his journey into believing that he's a prophet. Of course, they're always the last prophet, you know, and that they're going to be given some sort of revelation that no one else has been given yet. And so you get this with Joseph Smith. He's being contacted by, you know, an angel, Gabriel, and he's going to be receiving ultimately these.
Poor guy Gabriel. He always gets picked on.
That's the intriguing part, right?
He's like the angel of reformation or something like that.
And it reminds me of the Apostle Paul when he warned the church to be careful of even angels, like that. Be careful of men and be careful of angels that will come and share a different gospel than the one that you receive from Jesus Christ.
See, I think that's important to note, because for a lot of times we want to just dismiss this as them making it up. But it seems perfectly reasonable to think that they did indeed have a spiritual experience, but potentially demonic. Right?
Well, that gets interesting, because Muhammad ultimately concludes that his was demonic. Now, a lot of people will be like, what are you talking about? One of the things you got to hear me out straight off the bat is that everything I'm going to share today comes straight from their resources. I'm not making any of this stuff up. But so let's just press pause then on our conversation, and people need to know a couple things then. One being, when people think of the literature, Islamic literature that tells us about Islam, the first book that they think of is the Quran. Mm-hmm. Now, this is interesting when you compare the Quran with the Book of Mormon too. This would be another comparison, is that both of them come from above. They would both have been seen as coming from above, and this giving of, like, where Joseph Smith gets these golden tablets, and Muhammad is going to be getting these sayings that are going to make up the Quran that they would view as eternal. So they view the Quran as eternal, given to Muhammad. Now, when you read the Quran, what you find in there is some very interesting things. One of the first things you find is that the name Muhammad is only mentioned 4 times in the Quran, and very, very little is told of Muhammad in the Quran. But that makes sense, because the Quran is just a bunch of sayings. Mm-hmm. They are random sayings, and even in the verses you can have randomness within the verse. I mean, it could start off, one sentence starts off talking about one thing, and the next sentence could jump off into something totally different. Mm-hmm. And this makes sense when you realize how the Quran was given to Muhammad. These were sayings that were given to Muhammad throughout his life, and that they were recorded down by scribes, and they were recorded on anything. Sometimes they wrote on bone, sometimes they wrote on paper, jars, whatever they had available. They would write down what had been told to Muhammad from the angel Gabriel, and that this is then what he would recite. They would write down. Long story short, they weren't collected into the Quran until after his death. And in fact, it was a couple battles after he was dead. They began to lose, especially in one particular battle. A lot of the people who had memorized his sayings died. Yeah. And they realized, wow, if we lost these people, we're going to lose his sayings. And so then they put them they were commissioned to collect all these sayings and to put them together into one document.
It was one of the personal secretaries of Muhammad, as I understand it, who was commissioned by, was it Caliph Uthman, I think it was, to go collect these sayings, to sort of compile an authorized version.
Yeah, the guy who was authorized and the one that we ended up keeping, because there were multiple people that did this, mm-hmm. but there was one in particular that we kept. He's got a great name. Zayd ibn Thabit. It's pronounced something to that effect. He's got a great name. So it's a long story. It's actually a riveting story to know, like, learn how that all happened. I mean, after he collects it, he puts it under his bed. Some goats start eating it. He realizes he probably shouldn't put it there. Anyway, we can't get into all that.
Where can our listeners learn more about this?
Well, this is kind of where I'm leading, is that you begin to realize if you want to learn more about Islam, you really don't find it in the Quran. Mm-hmm. The Quran, again, is just a bunch of random sayings. In fact, that's how the Quran's ordered. It's ordered in surahs, and it starts with the largest surahs, which would be like chapters of sayings,
right,
to the smallest chapter of sayings. Mm-hmm. So you get this impression then there literally is no order, mm-hmm. to the book at all. It's just very, very random. And we'll pick up on pieces from the Old Testament, the New Testament. We'll talk about Jesus, for example, mm-hmm. and in fact, they think quite highly of Jesus. They would have seen him. They see him as one of their prophets. They would have seen him as the prophet before Muhammad. And in fact, they see him as one of the greatest prophets. In that, when you talk to them, the Quran tells you that Jesus was able to heal people. He was able to do miracles. He was able to bring people back from the dead. Mm-hmm. That's huge, particularly in light of Muhammad, in whom there are no miracles ascribed to.
When you talk to Muslims, typically they'll tell you that the Quran itself is the miracle.
And that was where I was just going to go. Yeah. So although he doesn't have a miracle that's ascribed to him, the only one that has kind of been ascribed to him is the Quran itself, mm-hmm. that the Quran is his miracle.
As I understand it, he was supposed to be illiterate. Is that correct? Because I hear some conflicting reports. Some say that he was illiterate. Others say, well, actually, he could at least sign his name and things like that. So I'm not sure what to think of that.
I don't know what to think about that either. I think that he would have been literate personally. Mm-hmm. But who knows? Maybe that's why he had people writing down his sayings for him and he didn't write them down himself. Mm-hmm. That's a possibility. I mean, some people have even argued the same thing that they've argued with Christianity, that Jesus, like how Jesus never existed. Some people will argue that Muhammad actually never existed.
Right.
That gets into a whole nother discussion. Maybe we could talk about next time. But I want to continue in, mm-hmm. on this. Well, okay, if you can't know about Muhammad from the Quran, where do you go? Well, you have to understand that Muslims hold to more sacred books than just the Quran.
Which, similar to Mormonism.
Similar to Mormonism, exactly.
Right. So what are some of these books?
Some of the ones that you should know about, there's two in particular you should know about. I believe there's five in total, though. Mm-hmm. So the Hadith would be the largest, and it covers all kinds of stuff in there and does talk about Muhammad. But the book that talks about directly about Muhammad is called The Life of Muhammad. And now, if you want to know, one of the things you got to be careful of when you're looking into their sacred books is it's not there's some that they think are true, if you will, and some
sacred.
Yeah, and some that aren't as true, in the sense that to them where it came from, it's chain of custody, if you will, like who told who. These are called isnads. Your isnad is important because they want to know if it's an authoritative isnad that goes back to Muhammad, mm-hmm. and how, you know, it's that whole phone tag thing. How many isnads to get back to Muhammad? So the shorter the chain, the more authoritative. But then beyond that, who translated it is incredibly important.
Right.
Because there was a long time that they would say, listen, if you're not reading the Quran in Arabic, then you're just not even reading the Quran.
Right.
But these days, you don't get that anymore. Now it's like, no, you can read it in English, but who translated it? Mm-hmm. Well, the same thing with Life of Muhammad. It needs to be translated by the right guy. In particular, the life of Muhammad that's translated by Ibn Ishaq is the authoritative mm-hmm. translation. Now, when you read this book, I have a copy with me here. This is a book that tells you all about his story. And so when I told you about him hearing from the angel Gabriel in the cave and whatnot, that comes from this book. And when he believed that he was demon-possessed. So when he started hearing and having these experiences, he was convinced he was demon-possessed. In fact, he was so convinced he was demon-possessed, he decided that he was going to take his life. He figured, I've lost my mind. I'm going to commit suicide. Now, you have to understand that the reason that Muhammad was able to just hang out in a cave and pray and whatnot is because he had a lot of time on his hands. And the reason he had time on his hands is because he married Khadijah. And you guys...
Yeah,
want to jump in there?
Yeah, Khadijah was she was a businesswoman. She was a merchant, right?
Quite a bit older than him.
About 15 years senior. Yeah. And so when Muhammad married Khadijah, he was about 25. She was about 40. At first, Muhammad worked for her. And after a number of successful caravan travels, he found favor in Khadijah's eyes, and then that evolved into love, and eventually they married, as the story goes.
Yeah, it sounds like they had a great relationship mm-hmm. from everything we know.
Mm-hmm. Now, just before we move on here, just to give our listeners a very rough historical framework, Chris, do you want to tell us a little bit about the timeline of Islam?
Sure. Just a really, really basic timeline. Has Muhammad is born in Mecca, Arabia. It's in Saudi Arabia now, but about 570 AD, about 610 AD is when the angel Gabriel visited him and told him he was the messenger of God. And then for the following 22 years, roughly, is when Muhammad spread his teachings that were revealed to him in Mecca and Medina until he died.
Those would be those sayings that are being told to him.
Right.
Yeah. So he was able to do that over to up until about 632. And then Islam sort of flourished from there. And it became divided about 13 years later or so. 645 is the date given. That this is when the Sunnis and the Shiites came into existence, the two major branches, with Sunni being obviously the more heavily populated.
Let's just pause there for a second, because people might be wondering, okay, how'd you get two branches, the Shiites and the Sunnis? Mm-hmm. And I think this is a great point, because we see this in a lot of religions and a lot of cults, that when the cult leader or religious leader dies, the question of who gets power next comes into question. Mm-hmm. This happened with Mormonism as well. You have two different branches of Mormonism. You got the Mormon branch that says, listen, whoever is the blood relative should get the power. And then another branch will say, no, it's whoever was his second in command mm-hmm. should have power. You have the exact same thing taking place with the Muslims. You got the Sunnis who believe.
They accept that the first four caliphs or the leaders are the legitimate successors of Muhammad.
Yeah, so those would be his leaders. Those would be those second in command. And then the Shiite would hold that, no, that the power should have been given to blood.
Yeah, just the one. Well, the Caliph Ali and his descendants are the legitimate successors to Muhammad. And so they reject the first three caliphs. So the fourth one, I guess, would be...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which would be because of a blood tie. So now you have more distinctions in Islam as well, but they're not
they're really minimal.
They're really minimal.
Yeah, it's like Sunnis represent something like they estimate 87 to 90%. Shiites they say is about 10. So I mean, if you do the math, the rest of the factions. So it's more factions within those two broader groups.
Right. And the two major factions that are worth mentioning would be the Sufis and would be folk Islam, is the title that's kind of been given to it. And these are worth mentioning, that the Sufis are, they tend to be much more...
they're mystics, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah. A good way to put it would be mystics. They're more interested in the spiritual life, if you will. Mm-hmm. I one time encountered some Sufis when I was in Egypt, and one of the things that they're known for is twirling. And right. So if they want to have a mystical experience with God, they will literally spin themselves into a tizzy until in their spinning around, they have these mystical experiences with God.
Hmm.
Now, the folk with regards to folk Islam, this is an incredibly important point just to note about all religions, because all religions have their folk version, but Islam especially has this. And what folk Islam is where you've got the animistic beliefs of a specific culture that are being adopted into and integrated with Islam.
It's like a syncretism.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a syncretism. And so that can confuse people. And I mention this all the time. It's very easy to get confused between what is the animistic cultural beliefs of that specific area or even town, and then what is the actual teachings of Islam, for example. So you can these can be difficult distinctions sometimes to parse out. And I know that, like a Muslim apologist or whatever, they'll definitely want to jump on this when it comes to certain things, like oh, I'm forgetting what it's called now. Like when honor killings, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll ask, okay, is an honor killing cultural? Is that part of the cultural animistic beliefs, or is that part of Islam? Right. And so that's a valid question.
I think just quickly that something that'll be relevant for when we continue to look at things like ISIS or think about things like ISIS is also the subsection under the Sunnis, which would be the Wahhabi movement, which was essentially, and some of it will, it's like Salafism. Is the movement, or in the, I believe it's in the Hadith, but it's essentially, it's, I'm sorry, not the Hadith. It's
Sunnis?
Yeah, I think so. And then it's, but essentially it's a reclamation project. Wahhabi was a theologian, Islamic theologian back in, I believe, the 18th century. And he said that essentially the way Islam had evolved over the centuries, it had gone astray, and it was trying to reform it back to original Islam. And then, so this is where you get a lot of these, the radical groups would be Wahhabi Sunnis, and they're the ones that are believing that they're doing as Muhammad would have them do, or the original peoples would have them, original Muslims would do.
Well, that might be a good place for me to jump back in then again. I apologize if in our rabbit trails we've lost on something. Send an email in if there's a point that we've missed. But yeah, because I remember we were on
the timeline.
On the timeline. Is there more you want to go on the timeline before?
Well, we could just say that the teachings of Muhammad were collected, as we talked about, just the time for that was in the early 650s. So 650 to 652 is the time that they typically would give to that. And then there would be further breaks and stuff like that in with either the Sunnis or the Shiites. There'd be small movements. But essentially that's when it was after that 650 time when Islam was essentially solidified and was a major movement then, though it went in a couple of directions, as we've mentioned.
Mm-hmm. So just to piggyback off of what you were talking about there, one of the things then that comes in the question, okay, if we're going to reform Islam, if we're going to go back to its original, if we're going to practice it in its purest form, what does that look like? Or how do we do that? Because a lot of people ask me this question. I get this all the time. Is Islam violent?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And
it's probably the most relevant question right now with everything that's going
especially
on,
especially with ISIS and, mm-hmm. and whatnot.
Right.
Suicide bombings.
And so this is a complicated question to answer in some ways, though, because if you look at, say, the book of their main book, if you look at the Quran, the Quran isn't overly violent. It's not, I didn't find it particularly violent, except for if you take a look at like Surah 9 or something like that.
The verse of the sword,
right? Right.
Where it actually commands that you are to lay ambush upon the infidels and kill them.
Right. Basically. Exactly. So, but in the whole book, I mean, that's not a lot, mm-hmm. right? So it's not like, so it's definitely there, but it's not a lot. Mm-hmm. So what you find then is if you have a Muslim that's just a nominal Muslim, which a lot are. They were born into Islam. And I'm not saying that derogatorily. Like, that's the way a lot of people around the world think.
Well, that's
certainly really true of Christianity. In the
Christianity, yeah, exactly. I know piles of nominal Christians.
I was one.
Yeah.
Right, so I was born, you know, it's like I was born in Korea, I'm Korean. Mm-hmm. That's the way a lot of people view their religion. Mm-hmm. I was born in this country of Christians, I'm Christian. You know, so same thing with Islam. I was born into this area. We're Muslim, so I'm Muslim, and that's a part of one. It's more than just what they believe. It's more than that. What it is for them, it's an identity.
It's a way of life.
Yeah, it's a way of life. And so what happens then is they rarely read the Quran, mm-hmm. and never read anything beyond it. Now, those Muslims, though, that this is what they believe, they're invested in this, they believe this, they read their Quran, and they practice it. They are the ones that read more. Now, this doesn't mean, then, that they're going to become radicalized or violent. But it does mean that they're introduced to more of the violence in Islam. And what you find is, you're not going to see it so much in the Quran, is you'll see it in the Hadith, but more than the Hadith, you see it in the book The Life of Muhammad. Mm-hmm. Now, this is important because for a Muslim, their chief desire and aim is to be like Muhammad. Now, think with me for a second. If your chief desire is to be like Muhammad, but Muhammad's only mentioned by name 4 times in the Quran and virtually tells you nothing about him, how do you learn about him? Well, either you're going to learn to be like him from those around you, or you're going to learn to be like him from reading the book, The Life of Muhammad. So what do you find when you look and you read the book, The Life of Muhammad? So I want to just camp there for a moment, and then I can pick up a rabbit trail that we left earlier, mm-hmm. where Muhammad believed he was demon-possessed and decided he was going to kill himself. He decides to go to kill himself. He's going to jump off a cliff. But the angel Gabriel talks him out of it, and he decides that he's going to go talk to Khadija, his wife, and see what she thinks.
Who was his biggest cheerleader, by the way, right? She was a great support for him.
She mm-hmm. was, because he told her about these sayings, about how this angel Gabriel's talking to him, and she supported him.
She was on board, yeah.
She was. However, the rest of the tribe he was from, called the Quraishi tribe, they were not on board with him. They didn't like Muhammad, and they wanted to dispose of Muhammad. They all thought he was demon-possessed as well. Now, again, you're like, where are you getting this, Andy? I'm getting this from The Life of Muhammad. It's not like they're trying to cover any of this stuff up. It's very explicit.
Yeah, I'll put this up on the website, but this is from Oxford University Press, so this is not just from some self-published work.
This right.
legitimate.
This is what they believe.
And it's a self-published work.
Anyway, and if you talk to... yeah.
Just kidding.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it. So, and if you talk to an imam, which is like the equivalent of a Muslim pastor or something like that, they're going to tell you absolutely if it's translated, who it's translated by, it's legit. Anyway, so what does it tell us happens? It says that Muhammad goes back to Khadija, a big supporter of his. Oh, by the way, this was important. Why then doesn't the Quraishi tribe kick him out? You know, because they all don't like him. They all think he's demon-possessed. Well, because of Khadija and her wealth and his family, and particularly the wealth that they had power. And they were able to keep the tribe at bay and leave Muhammad alone. You'll find out, though, as soon as they die, as soon as his wife dies, as soon as others in his family die, he doesn't have that power any longer, and he does get kicked out of the Quraishi tribe and flees to Medina.
Medina.
Yeah, right. So we'll deal with that later. But just to stick with this rabbit trail, He goes back to Khadijah, tells her that he's fearful, he's demon-possessed, he's going to take his life, and Khadijah comes up with an idea to determine whether or not he's crazy or not. And she determines that the next time that he sees the angel Gabriel, that she needs to that he needs to tell her, and that she's got this plan. And so this all happens. She's got this plan. He tells her. And Khadijah tells him, okay, Muhammad, I want you to sit on my right thigh. And so he does. And she says, can you still see the angel Gabriel? And he says, I can. And so she starts to take off some clothes and says, okay, you sit on my left thigh. Can you still see the angel Gabriel? And says, yes, I can. This goes on until she's naked and says, can you see the angel Gabriel? To which he says, no, I can't. And Khadijah says, see, look, Muhammad, you're not crazy. You're not demon possessed. It's all legit. I'm not 100% sure how that made it all legit, but that's the story that's told. He decides he's not demon possessed. He's not crazy. And so he continues. And if anything, this really gives him the passion and the vigor to really to pursue this, that he is the messenger of God. He's God's last prophet, and God's going to start speaking to him. Now, this is really a side hobby until he gets kicked out of the Quraysh tribe and flees to Medina. And this then gets kicked into overdrive, this whole thing. But the whole point of where I was going with all this is, if you want to know what it means then to be like Muhammad, if you're a Muslim and you're really getting into it, then you got to look in the life of Muhammad. And these are some of the things that you find. It's a book that is absolutely full of violence. It's full of death and killing, and begins to help people to understand the way that Muslims think. So I'll just not to read a whole lot into this. My point in reading this, by the way, is just so that people can understand Islam. It's not to make you afraid of Muslims. We want you to love people and to share your faith with them. This isn't to scare you, but to give you an idea of what they think. So just to give you a few details, in page 578, we read in one of the battles that a Muslim warrior praised Muhammad, saying, I saw him crush the heads of the polytheists, throttle with, by the way, that's a Christian, would be a polytheist.
Polytheist, because they thought we worshiped three gods.
That's right. And
Father, Son,
and
Mary.
And Mary. Yeah, I was going to see if you saw that one. In the Quran, they view that, I believe it's in the Quran, that they talk about the Trinity. They misrepresent the Trinity as Father, Son, and Mary. So that for that reason, that so they call Christians polytheists. So throttle with bare hands, splitting their skulls with swords, continual cuts and threats at the enemy. I jumped in around in there just to the main thoughts on page 578. One of Muhammad's more ruthless moments was when he ordered the death of Uqba. I can't pronounce any of these guys' names.
Uqba.
Let's go with that. Who asks, but who will look after my children, O Muhammad? To which Muhammad replies, hell, and then proceeds to kill him. In another instance, Muhammad, being kept awake at night by a wounded prisoner, became so angry he ordered his death in the morning. He killed some poet. Now, this is an important one. That was page 310, by the way. Here's page 597. He killed some poets in Mecca who made fun of him while the remaining ones fled for their lives. Apostates found no mercy with Muhammad. At the Battle of Mecca, he ordered that they all be killed without mercy, even if they didn't resist. That's page 550. God revealed to Muhammad that once his treaty with the polytheists had expired to kill them. He made treaties at first with the Jews and with the Christians. He first expired the treaties with the Jews and began killing Jews. Then he expired the treaty with the Christians and began killing Christians. Here's one last one. And by the way, I've got pages of these. When I read the book, I just took notes as I read through it. But just here's another one just to show you on page 551. Muhammad ordered two singing girls to be killed because they had sung satirical songs about him. So you can begin to understand then why they would kill people that make fun of Muhammad, because that's what Muhammad did. And you'll see this throughout the book, The Life of Muhammad. Some of the things was like, I just don't get why they act that way. Well, that they read that that's how Muhammad acted, and their desire is to be like Muhammad, so they behave in the same way he does. Now, this is a little bit more complicated in that Muslims revere Muhammad. Mm-hmm. Like we're talking, they revere him in ways that's really difficult for Christians, I think, to understand. In that, in many ways in Islam, they view things differently than we do. For example, they don't view Muhammad the way that we view Jesus. Really, they would view the Quran in the way
that the word of God.
Yeah, the word of God, the way that we view Jesus. Mm-hmm. So that there's some distinctions there. Then they become difficult for a Christian to understand the way that a Muslim is thinking.
But at the same time, I think like we're taught or encouraged to try to emulate the life of Christ. Right?
Right.
So in that sense, there is, I think, a connection in that they're essentially taught or feel as though they're to emulate the life of Muhammad, though obviously there's a difference because they don't deify Muhammad as we deify Christ.
Right.
So there's a major distinction, but...
Yeah, so then in that way, they would view Muhammad the way a Christian views the Bible, would be the comparison.
Okay.
And so just in the same way that a Christian doesn't like it when the Bible's being made fun of, the Muslims don't like it when Muhammad's being made fun of, because that's who they're looking to be like, right? That's their model of the way they are to live, in the same way that the Bible is the way is the model for us and the way to live. In particular, Jesus is the the one of the ways that I've often put it is like this: the Bible isn't a book of like rules and regulations on this is how you're to live your life. It's more a book of seeking to give you advice and good rules to follow. But then and Jesus becomes this is the word made flesh. This is who you're to emulate. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah.
You know, like the reason I'm saying that is because you could think about how could God have revealed the Bible to us? Well, he could have just revealed a rule book to you, but God didn't reveal a rule book to us. He gave us a book full of story of people in relationship with God, right? And about sometimes they get it right, sometimes they get it wrong. And ultimately he's giving them guidance along the way. And then in the New Testament, God gives us, instead of giving us this rule book, right? We've got the Bible, but then he gives us Jesus Christ. It's the word made flesh and living amongst us, right? Mm-hmm. So that we see the way he lives. So when you compare this to the way that the Muslim is viewing things, their scriptures are not narrative driven. It's not like they're like the Quran, for example. It is sayings. It's these sayings that are supposed to give guidance to their life. But then it on top of these sayings, it's the life of Muhammad that you need to follow after, and your life needs to emulate his.
So that the Quran you're saying would be more abstract, right? So there's not really a narrative, a story to latch onto to try to follow after.
Right.
So instead you seek to look at the life of Muhammad for the examples.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. But there's no negative in the example. So like when we look, for example, a Christian will look at the life of David, and we can find redeeming things in his life to emulate, but he gets it wrong and he gets it right.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And ultimately, when we look at the story of King David, who's the story really about? The story's really about God, right? It's really about how God remains faithful, and about how God uses David, and about their relationship. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And to me, I think that's one of the beauties of Christianity, is this idea that it's about God in relationship with people. Now, when we come back next time and we get more into Islam, what you're going to find is that Islam is not about having a relationship with God. It's not about God being in relationship with you, and it's not about you being in relationship with God. Muhammad didn't even have a relationship with Allah. He had a relationship with an angel mediator that mediated between him and Allah, because Allah is is far and beyond. He is transcendent.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you are lowly human, and God is transcendent deity. And although you can come near to Allah, you cannot have a relationship in any sense that a Christian understands it with God. And this then becomes a real barrier for doing ministry to Muslims, because with Muslims, because they have such a hard time with this idea of Jesus Christ and that God would humble himself and become obedient even to death for us lowly humans. Mm-hmm. Whereas the Muslim seeks to be a Muslim, which the word means to
submit.
Exactly.
Islam,
so you
submission.
Yeah.
Muslim is one.
Thank you. Islam means submission. And Muslim is one who submits.
Right.
Thanks, Steve. And so that's ultimately the goal, is you submit to God and you ultimately seek to do as much good as you can. And at the end of the day, Allah's going to weigh your good and bad deeds, and he's going to determine if you make it into paradise or not. Paradise being nearness to Allah, in which you get all the things in earthly life that you have been barred from, such as alcohol and sex. And so the only way then to make sure that you get into paradise would be jihad. Mm-hmm. And that would be dying for a
holy cause.
Yeah, a holy cause. So there's a start into Islam.
All right. Well, let's wrap it up there for now. And when we come back, we'll continue on with part two of Encounter with Muslims, and we'll talk a little bit more about their theology, their view of God, their view of their anthropology, if you will, their view of human beings and what sin means and all of that stuff. So come back next time, and thank you for joining us. The Apologetics Canada podcast has been the Ministry of Apologetics Canada. Bye-bye now.